Succession number 23447, reel 6.
Mr. Waller, reel 6. Now, we sort of looked at what life was like while you were in the desert, you know, almost during the siege of Tobruk, while you were in the lines between Tobruk and obviously Cairo. Do you remember any events or any action or fighting or that happened during that period?
Not any small scale actions, you know, column work, if you. Or scouting patrols, things like that.
What do you remember? Were you on any of them, or would they take the anti-tank guns with them on those?
On a column, on what used to be called the old jock column, yeah, you take anti-tank guns on that, same as you took a 25-pounders.
What was a jock column? Now, just explain what it was and what a typical one would be like.
Well, it was made up of, shall we say, 25-pounders, some tanks, light tanks, the old Stuart Honeys, they call them, and the idea, and sort of lorried infantry, not heavy infantry, but more or less motorised infantry like ourselves, and the idea was to try and penetrate behind what was known as the enemy line and attack their supply columns. When I say there were no fixed lines, you were in a position, but you didn't have a sort of fixed 45 line like you did at Alamein or anything like that. It was more the box type, where you formed a box, and they were more or less the same, the Germans and the Italians, you know, they formed an area similar to our boxes, and... But they had to be supplied, so what you did was try and cut their supply line and do as much.
And what you remember, how many did you go on, or was it just one?
No, we did about two or three.
And do you remember anything that happened?
Well, only that you would spot, if you spotted a supply column, then the 25-pounders would drop off and start the shelling, and the infantry would then, and the Bren gun carriers would go forward and... try and shoot up particularly the Bren gun carriers would try and shoot up any ones that the shelling hadn't done, and that was the whole object of the exercise, you know, stop rations and petrol, water getting through. But it was quite effective, I believe. But
did you come under much counter fire?
No, not really, because you picked your targets. You didn't pick on a group of tanks, you picked on the soft-skin vehicles.
Anything else about it? I mean, it was quite a long time, about 6 or 7 months.
Yeah.
Anything else come to mind?
No, it was, you know, sort of a quiet period, really, preparing and doing that. And you were still doing patrol work, of course.
Tell me about the patrol work. You wouldn't go on the patrols, would you, with the anti-tank gun?
Well, you took your turn, but it was mainly the infantry platoons that did it.
And what were the patrols like?
Well, there were three types. You had the listening patrol, which you went out and trying to establish what was in front of you. You had another patrol where you were trying to get a prisoner. And then you had a fighting patrol where you went out, dashed in, did a short, sharp action, and then ran back, you know. And they're all at night, of course. I mean, once you got clear, you open fire. The thing might only last 10 minutes.
And which did you go on? Which type were you on?
I was maybe on the fighting patrol, trying to get capturing a prisoner.
Do you remember anything in particular about it?
Well, they were a bit lively, you know. Particularly the fighting patrols, you try to. The idea was that the transport dropped you off, and then you walked and crawled till you got near the thing, and then there was a short, sharp fight, opening fire, and they would open fire back, of course. And the only way they could spot where you were your muzzle flashes. So if you could get in quickly, after 10 minutes you just, you know, disappear or move to one side or move back. And
what arms, what weapons would you carry?
Oh, Tommy gunners, Bren gunners and rifles. And sometimes grenades, of course. That was the basic infantry stuff. Because we, the reason we did it, although we were anti-tank gunners, we had been trained as infantry initially, so we were already trained for it. And it was a question of, you couldn't keep sending the same company out each night, you know, each platoon, so everybody sort of had to do their bit.
Now, what did you think of the Thompson? I don't think we've talked about the Thompson so far.
It was heavy. It was a heavy thing to carry around, particularly if you had the drum on it, which is the 50-round drum. The 20-round straight magazine was better. But I plumped for... I, in those days, picked up a Schmeisser, a German Schmeisser, and I found them very... found that very effective, and I lovingly stuck to those more or less for the rest of my time in the desert.
Well, tell me, why did you? What did you like about it? Could you sort of describe the operation of the Schmeisser a bit, what it was like to use?
Well,
and why you liked
it? It was a lot lighter. It was a lot lighter than a Thompson submachine gun, and it seemed to, it's less likely to jam with the sand and stuff. And it was easy to maintain. It was easy to strip down and clean. So, in any case, the Thompsons were in short supply. I mean, normally they only had so many, which were dished out for a patrol. But in normal circumstances, your corporal in charge of your section might have one, but the rest of you have rifles. They were in rather limited supply. So if you could pick up a German or Italian weapon that was a good one, you picked it up.
What about ammunition supply? Was that for the Schmeisser? I mean, was it easy enough to find?
Yeah, fair enough. You could get hold of it. You know, I mean, you always found that. See, if you found a knocked out truck or you went on a patrol and you knocked anything out, you always tried to grab some of the ammunition to keep it going. And I mean, the first one I had was a little bit knocked about, shall we say, and because when I got a chance to pick another one up, I picked another one up, and I was quite happy with it. The other thing was it had a sling, which Thompson didn't have, and you could carry it on your shoulder, and you could also have the sling on your shoulder when you fired it, if you just sort of hose piping into trucks or enemy infantry. So that was a good advantage. That.
Anything else about the sort of the fighting patrols or the raids that you made?
Well, it was a regular thing. Both sides were doing it. And
do you remember any of the German raids on you or patrol attacks on you?
No, I was fortunate there. We escaped. I don't know why, but perhaps we weren't what they were looking for, you know. They were.
Did you get any sort of local leave back in Cairo or Alexandria during that period of months?
No.
So what's the next thing you remember? Would it be the actual break? Well, it's a break in, really.
Yeah.
Combined with a break out, but the relief of Tobruk. What do you remember of the operations there?
Well, as I say, the whole columns were moving up. And we were more inland rather than on the coast road going direct to Tobruk. And, you know, we ran into stiff opposition from the German tanks, the Panzers, and such like. And, of course, the nearer you got to Tobruk, they were dug in. The Germans and the Italians were dug in round there. So it was... It stiffened up. The nearer you got, the stiffer it got. But
what do you remember of that? I mean, do you remember any of it in any detail?
No, you see, any fighting is confused, but desert fighting is, you know, you know what's going in your section, in your little area. You're moving forward, and
that's all I mean, really, is what happened to you. What do you remember of your sort of perspective of it?
Well, we were fairly lucky. We didn't... our company, I mean, we said there were, you know, some casualties within the A company that we were attached to. But on the anti-tank guns, we were extremely lucky. We didn't suffer any casualties. And, mind you, we had the, as I say, the easier part because we were on the inside, more the desert side rather than the coastal road, and it was a lot stiffer there. So, but no, that particular episode was quite pleasant. You know, it was a ride back. It was more skirmishes goes on. You know, we didn't get involved in attacking fixed positions. We were taking on transport mainly.
You were still quite inexperienced. How did you feel in action? Were you nervous or not nervous? How did you feel?
Well, you get butterflies in your tummy, but once you get going, it's a question of you do it automatically. You know, it's like all your training. And all the time you're thinking, I better get my shot off first before they get their shot off at you. So, you know, I think particularly tanks were always a worry. Armoured cars and soft vehicles, no, that was all right. You felt it was a fairly even chance you had. But tanks, it was the range, your range and their range. I mean, they had a 75mm, 50 and 75mm guns on, and you had a 6-pounder, so they were going to, if they could get your range, they were going to hit you first before you could fire back, so you were always a bit nervous over that.
So, where did you go? I mean, did you move into the Tobruk area, or were you one of the units that went on past Tobruk?
No, we went on past Tobruk. Trying to think of how far we went. We were moving up. We got past Tobruk. I think we were moving up towards Benghazi. Because we got to Benghazi, and we used to get a day pass to go into, because you just stopped wherever you were. You know, it's not as if you had tents or anything like that. I mean, you just slept on the ground, so wherever your truck pulled up, that was home, and they were scattered around. So in the event of an air raid, you know, you weren't a clustered up target. So you were all spread out, and as I say, they organised a day trip into Benghazi, and it was...
What do you remember of that?
Well, it was very pleasant. To be able to see the sea was nice, and they opened up the equivalent of a naffy, but it was a club for other ranks, and where you could get a cup of tea or sort of cake or something like that. And
what about the local population?
They were quite good because I'm trying to think where. Yeah, because you see, and they'd been occupied, certainly in Tripolitania. They'd been occupied by the Italians for years, so we were looked upon as liberators. But it was the further you got towards. Further up you got, the better you were received. So, Benghazi and Tripoli, there weren't enough, shall we say, local population to worry about, but Benghazi wasn't, and they were very rewarding towards us, you know.
They made you welcome.
Yeah.
And what happened next? You were advanced to got to Benghazi. Any further? Or?
We were more or less round that area, just slightly up. That might have been to Gazala then. And that was before the German counterattack, and that's about as far as we got.
So you never got back into Egypt. You stayed out and took your place in the Gazala line.
Yeah.
Now, what you were in the Gazala. is our lines for a couple of months before the big German attack in late May, early June. Mm. What's your memory of your time in the Gazala lines? Whereabouts were you in the box? I'm not sure which box you were in.
It's very difficult because the 9th Battalion, who I was with, I think it was, I could be a bit out, but we were under about 40 different commands in 2 years, and you were forever, somebody would come up and say, oh, we're now under command of so-and-so. Now, so, you know, you really didn't know what the hell was going on. And it was just a question, you were told, we want you there. And you would settle down. And as I say...
So you wouldn't know if you were in 151 Brigade box or 150 box?
No, you were just sort of moved about and suddenly would come up and say, oh, we want it over there, you know, get the guns on the portees and off you go and drop you down. But you didn't really know where the hell you were. It was completely confusing. And... as I say, I think about the only time I can remember who I was under command was when we were attached to the Guards Brigade. And that was round about the Tobruk area, you know, until they got annihilated, and then we got attached to somebody else.
So what's the first thing you remember? I mean, what do you remember? Was there anything particular happened in the period in the Gazala line, or is the first thing that happened really for you the big attack?
Yeah, well, there were probing attacks, you know. They made probing attacks and sort of reconnaissance in force, as it was described. And that was when suddenly they might say, you're wanted over there, armoured cars or tanks have been sighted, and they rush you off to somewhere, and you there might be some... You might get some fire in between you. You might not. You know, they might withdraw after a few shots. And really, you were being used a bit like a fire brigade. Whenever there was a breakthrough, you were transferred to wherever it looked like a reconnaissance in force was coming, and you were sent over there to stop it. As I say, a bit like a fire brigade. That's the nearest I can.
Yep. By then, had you made special friends?
There were a group of us, and there was a chap called Bill Ash, who was a friend of mine to the day he died. The corporal in charge of the gun, Alf Reeves, we were very friendly with him, although we lost touch with him after the war when we came out. But we do know he survived. And there were two others.
This is your actual gun team, isn't it?
Yeah. You see, the three of us on the gun were Alf Reeves, Bill Ash and myself.
Now, tell me about that. Tell me about Corporal Alf Reeves. What was he like? Give us an idea of what he was like.
He was a nice enough bloke. He was a country chap. Worked on a farm. Because I always remember when we were back one time in Cairo area, around in the Delta area, there was an Arab coming along with a donkey with a great big load on its back. And in order to keep it going, where the saddle and the load had rubbed and sore, he kept poking a stick in it. And Alf Reeves, being a countryman who loved animals, immediately went up and gave him a right-hander and cut the load off the donkey. So he was one of those types, but he was a... quietest chap, you know, countryman that sat down and thought everything through, and I think that's why he was got promoted.
And he was friendly as a corporal too.
Oh yes, yes, yes.
He didn't stand on the rank.
No.
And what about was it Rifleman or Private Bill Ash? What was he?
Yeah, Bill Ash. Well, as I say, we got powered up, and he was the sort of chap that I don't know how to describe him. I think he had his nerves cut out. He didn't get nervous. He was just took everything in his stride, and he always wanted to be doing something. It was a quiet period. He'd find some German ammunition and start with some pliers, pull it out, because it was all colour coded, you see. And what's this? What's the red thing? Oh, that's incendiary, you know. And until he pulled one out, which was black, and it exploded. It went bang. And, oh, shot it. But he was always doing that. And or if it was quiet, he would get empty cans, food tins, or beer can, and stuff it with loose cordite, make a homemade bomb and try and blow the bumper off a knocked out truck, you know. He's always doing things like that. He couldn't peacefully settle down, you know. He had to be doing something all the time.
So there's Reeves and Ash and yourself. Anyone else in your gun team?
Well, not on the gun. You had a brain gunner. I can't remember his Sid. I can't remember his Christian name. And the driver of the Paltee was Mogridge, Bill. Not Bill. Ah, it might come to me in a moment, but...
Mogridge,
yeah.
What was he like?
He was a chirpy little fellow. He was always worrying. He'd been hit earlier on, some months earlier, by a bit of shrapnel. And when he came out of hospital, he had a V-shape in his ball bag. And he was always worrying when he went home. What am I going to tell my mother and my girlfriend if they say, show us your wound, you see? But he was a chirpy little fella. Sid was a rather solemn type. He was the one that used to attract the flies because of all his desert sores. And we lost him after a while. He had to go back. They got so bad, they had to take him back.
And this gun team, so this, you know... You
see, it's three of you together, and as I say...
And by now you had the six-pounder as well, didn't you? You just had them issued.
Well, we got them issued just as when the Battle of Knightsbridge started.
Sorry, right. So yeah. No, yeah, leave it to that, yeah. Mm. So, and between you were a little... You were close friends.
Yes, and I mean, you lived together on the truck, on the Paltee. You lived together, you cooked together... Virtually everything together.
Now, what about your sergeant and your officer? Do you remember who they were?
At the time.
Or how they, you know, how you got on with them?
Oh, yes, you got on them. I mean, I'll give you an idea. One thing that always stands up my mind, one of the sections got a new officer, and he sat there and waited for them to give him his meal. So when the chap went up and saw the company commander, he said, you know, this new officer, so he sits there, he won't do anything. He said, well, tell him what to do. He said, tomorrow you cook your breakfast and don't give him any. And if he complains, tell him, well, if he takes his turn, that's it. And that is what it was like in the desert. There was a very close, there was no standing on rank. There was a close camaraderie, and you all mucked in.
Officers and NCOs as well.
Officers and NCOs, yeah. You didn't see too much of the officers. You had a platoon officer, but there were four guns, four sections. And he was at platoon HQ, so he lived with them. And he used to come out and see what was going on, inspect the guns, you know, and pass any information on, you know, keep your eyes open. Something had been reported, vehicles moving. But... otherwise, you were a self-contained unit. You relied entirely on your number one, who was either a corporal or a sergeant, in charge of your gun, and your gun loader and your gun aimer, firer.
Now, what about your NCOs, other than, you know, your corporal? Yeah. What do you see much of them? I mean...
What was...
Your NCO, you know, the yeah. sergeant. Platoon
you had
sergeant.
A platoon sergeant.
Would you see him more than the officers, or the same?
Oh, you see him more than the officers, yes, because he... came round, but in fact, the platoon sergeant was usually with in section of two guns, so he would be keeping an eye on the two of them.
Now, when you were in, what do you remember of the lead up to the big battle? Well, the Battle of Knightsbridge.
Yeah.
What do you remember of the lead up to that?
Well, as I say, much as before, you know, there were these probes going on, and you'd be hauled here, there and everywhere until suddenly all hell broke loose and they said, you know, tanks have broken through, there's a column of German tanks broken through and you were just rushing around like wild mad things, you know. I mean, nobody really knew what was happening. Those in the box, it was like with Ray Ellis in his box.
You weren't in the same box as the Southampton Stars, were you?
No. We, as I say, we were being used like a, wherever we wanted.
So what happened to you when the Germans broke through? What happened in your box? Well, where you were, rather?
Yeah, we were chasing about. Well, we would be pushed there, and if they came through, we would open fire, and obviously there were too many of them. We'd start pulling back. Sometimes they might come and then they veer off somewhere else to bypass a strong defensive position. But
now, just before, you'd been issued with the 6-pounders.
Yeah. Well, see, we started the battle with a 2-pounder, and just after it started, they suddenly came through and said, right, you wanted, take your guns back. And we went away. Wherever it was, it wasn't too far away, and obviously on the, they must have brought them up through to Brook, I presume, and we just, there they had these 6-pounders, and we said, well, what about some instruction? They said, oh, you don't need, you just put a round up the barrel, up the breech and fire it. We said, well, you're sitting down on a 2-pounder. And a 2-pounder had a, on the sight, had a, about 6-inch concertinaed rubber piece on the end. So you put your eye right against it, so that when it fired, it rocked back, and the rubber, concertina rubber, took the, cushioned the effect. But a 6-pounder was entirely different. For one thing, with the size of the charge, it reared up. Initially, until the two spades of the gun dug into the ground. But it meant that when you wanted to fire it, you didn't put your eye near the thing, you kept it about 12 inches away. Unfortunately, we had a couple of them put them their eyes too near. When they fired it, the thing reared up and bang, hit them either in the eye or chopped the eye, and we lost two layers like that.
Off your gun or in
not, the not off our gun, no, out of the company.